Okay, Marsha, we're ready to go.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Sleater, Judge Gaitis, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're here for our third oral argument on today's calendar. In this case is A21-0396, State of Minnesota, Respondent versus Midwest Bonding Appellant. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes rebuttal if you want to use that. At the start of your principal arguments, please identify yourself and the party that you represent for our record. And counsel for appellant, we're ready for you if you're ready to go.
Whoops, can you hear me now? Good morning. My name is Jim McGeaney, MC capital G E E N E Y, attorney for appellant Midwest Bonding. May it please the court, counsel. I'd like to start off by just pointing out the principal points of our arguments on why the district court abused its discretion in denying appellant's petition to reinstate and discharge the bonds in this matter. I don't think the facts are really in dispute here, so I'll go straight to the four Shetsky factors. I'm sure this court is aware of the Shetsky factors in the seminal case that's still the state of the law in Minnesota. The reason that the district court erred in applying the first Shetsky factors, the first Shetsky factor, is that the district court relies on prior fails to appear from the defendant on bonds that are not at issue in this appeal. In other words, the district court cites the fact that the defendant failed to appear 5 times in this case, and that was something that the district court considered, and we believe considered greatly in its decision to deny the bond reinstatement petition. Respondent argued in their brief that the district court didn't substantially or materially rely on that fact, but it's clear from the court's order. It's on addendum 14 in its decisional paragraph. Here, defendant has failed to appear on 5 separate occasions. Well, it's true that the defendant failed to appear 5 times in this case, but there was only 1 failure to appear on the bonds posted at issue here. So we believe the district court erred in relying on times that the defendant failed to appear that when these bonds were not posted to ensure the defendant's appearance. Your Honor, interesting in the second factor, I point that the respondent's encouraging this court to publish its opinion in this case, relying on the unpublished dicta in Aiden, or the unpublished language in Aiden, for the holding that Midwest or appellant's actions aren't to be considered in the second factor. And, you know, the second factor from Shetsky are the good faith efforts of the bond company as measured by the fault or willfulness of the defendant.
Here, Mr. McGeaney, doesn't the third factor actually also consider the good faith and efforts of the bond company? And so aren't you essentially asking us to double up on that consideration?
Well, not really. I think that, you know, the Shetsky case is still the law. I think the order is incorrect. I think when you make this analysis, the third factor should be considered first in your analysis. What were the good faith efforts made by the surety? And then apply the second factor. How do you measure the good faith efforts against the fault or willfulness of the defendant? I'm just pointing that out because the two factors are interrelated. And I think it's confusing, and the case law is confusing. And I think that this court got it wrong in Aden, by the way. We didn't petition. That was my case. We didn't petition for review because that was a decision my client made. But clearly, the Supreme Court in Storkamp discussed this, measuring the good faith efforts of the surety against the fault or willfulness of the defendant. It's cited in my brief on page 8, the quote from Storkamp, where the Supreme Court said, look, when we don't mean to say, and up to Storkamp, most of the appellate cases said, hey, the defendant was willful in his failure to appear. That factor weighs against reinstatement. And the Supreme Court in Storkamp said, wait a minute, hold on. We never meant for that to be true. In other words, it's not a done deal just because the defendant willfully failed to appear. That factor weighs against reinstatement. This court, all the judges in this court are well aware that if you've practiced in criminal law or been on the bench for a while, the large majority of cases where a defendant fails to appear for court is willful. It's a rare occurrence when a defendant is not willfully failing to appear. So if you're going to just automatically say that factor weighs against reinstatement and discharge because of the willful failure to appear, that discounts what the Supreme Court said in Storkamp. And they said, we never meant for this bad faith to automatically trump the good faith efforts. That's why I think the analysis is kind of backwards, why we always look at the second factor first. I think we should look at the third factor before the second factor, but you know, I'm not publishing the opinions.
Mr. McGeaney, on that point, would essentially then the net result of two and three almost, if there's any showing of good faith and there's always unwillfulness, generally be neutral factors and not determinative in any case in which Chesky's reviewed? Because one's going to offset the other. So it's very willful, but you had good faith. So those two kind of end up being a wash, and we look at the other factors for a determinative result.
Well, I suppose there are circumstances where that would hold true, but each case is fact specific. And I don't know that in every case you're going to find that the surety made good faith efforts, or were the good faith efforts enough? And I'll get to that because the district court here.
I kind of assume that. I just assume you're generally arguing, of course, there was good faith as you are today. And my point being is, as you say, they are seem a bit confusing as you look at those two, because if you look at the bonding company in relation to willfulness, but it uses good faith, they become almost unhelpful for our review, at least as factors and then for a district court.
Well, Your Honor, I don't necessarily disagree, but you know, we work with the case law that we have, and we argue with the factors that are there. So I see your point. I guess to answer your question as best I can, I think that, you know, each case is fact specific, and, you know, there's going to be times where we have information about why the defendant failed to appear. It's rare, but we do. And I've had cases where we know what happened. The majority of the cases, we don't know what happened. And in those cases, and I think counsel quoted me from the transcript, if I can't present to the district court in my hearing evidence about unwillfulness, then I have to concede. I guess you can infer that the defendant failed to appear willfully. But I think the analysis in this case is incorrect by the district court, because and by respondent. Respondent says, basically, and the district court basically held, hey, it was a willful failure to appear. This factor weighs against reinstatement. And I think the district court erred in not considering the good faith efforts and then weighing them. And the district court, you know, basically summarizes appellant's good faith efforts as minimal. I'm not going to take this court's time to go through the record is clear. The affidavit, which was unrefuted in the district court, by the way, the affidavit sets out Midwest efforts or the appellant's efforts, and they were extensive. I think, and moving on to the third factor, you know, one of the things that the respondent is relying on is that appellant didn't, you know, submit an itemized list of expenses and what costs they incurred. And I don't know that should be determinative. Just because certain cases, you know, Storkamp talks about it. The fact that, you know, there was $1,000 in costs weighed in favor of the decision to reinstate and discharge the bond. And Vang talks about it as well. I would just argue this morning that any reliance on Vang is misplaced. Vang is a distinguishable case. In Vang, the offender was never apprehended. In fact, as far as I know to date, Vang has never been apprehended and prosecuted in that case. So I don't know if you can use the facts from Vang in the analysis, but the good faith efforts of appellant are unrefuted. This is a civil case. You know, the first Chesky factor says the civil nature of these proceedings. Respondent did not submit any evidence in the district court, no affidavits, no receipts about costs incurred or those kinds of things. And so in the third factor, the district court's reliance on presumptions that there was In costs incurred and efforts made trying to locate Tao, the defendant in this case, are not supported by evidence in the record. What respondent argues in their brief and what the district court did in its order were just concluded without any evidentiary support that the state must have incurred expenses. You know, the record is clear that the defendant in this case was not apprehended as a result of law enforcement looking for, I don't know if it's a him or a her, I apologize, looking for the defendant.
She's a woman, but I'll just note that she also wasn't apprehended based on the efforts of Midwest, right? So
she wasn't. We
cuts we both ways.
Well, we concede that, Your Honor, but I don't know that that's a determinative fact. You know, the case law doesn't say that the surety has to make good faith efforts and apprehend the offender. And again, we're all experienced attorneys and judges here. The large majority of defendants are apprehended by law enforcement for obvious reasons. There's much more resources available to law enforcement. The defendant in this case, as often happens, was apprehended on an unrelated matter. Now, the state
Can I move you, Mr. McGinney, to the fourth factor?
Absolutely.
I'm hoping to have a discussion about that because I think everyone agrees the state didn't make an appearance in this case or do anything in relation to the record about prejudice to the administration of justice. You argue in your brief that the state had some burden there, but my understanding is that actually the applicant for reinstatement has the burden. And I'm just wondering if you have any authority for your proposition that the state had some burden here. And then I may have a few follow-up questions.
Of course, Your Honor. I'll cite the court to State v. Askland, the Minnesota Supreme Court in 784 Northwest 2nd at page 62. It's in my brief. And I'll cite it. The burden is on the state to prove any claimed prejudice. And it's solely on the prejudice in prosecuting the defendant. You know, Shetsky talks about it and Storkamp talk about it. So the burden's on the state. And, you know, inconvenience is not prejudice under the law in Minnesota.
So here the district court seemed to go beyond considering prejudice to the prosecution and considered prejudice to the administration of justice, including to the court's own schedule, it seems to me, looking at the order, is it your position that that's an abuse of discretion?
Yes. I'm looking at the court's order, and I think what Your Honor's referring to is the district court's finding that prejudice to the state was substantial because the defendant absconded from a scheduled jury trial date. And then the district court went on to say in its analysis, the state also had to bear the extra cost of arresting the defendant multiple times and holding her, there you go, it is a her, in custody multiple times. There's no evidence in the record that the state incurred extra cost. Again, this is a district court's presumption without any evidence in the record being presented by the state that they incurred additional costs that they wouldn't have incurred anyway.
Can a district court presume that failure to appear for a jury trial, you know, not just an appearance that happens in the regular course of the court's business, but a jury trial is prejudicial, or is that error?
I think that's error as well, without evidence in the record that there was some kind of I'll give the court an example. So, and I have another case coming up to another panel where a defender absconds during the trial. Well, is there prejudice there? Maybe, but we don't know anything about that jury trial calendar. Were there 40 cases on that calendar? And was it a cattle call or a status call? Was it a date certain trial where the witnesses and the jury were in the veneer ready to go and she failed to appear? There's no evidence in the record of what that meant. What, you know, there's lots of jury calendars and jury trial calendars that are not necessarily the day that the jurors are going to be in the courthouse and they're getting paid and the witnesses.
So it's your position, relying on the Askland case, that the state had some affirmative obligation to come forward with that kind of information.
Absolutely. Not only to that, also to the finding by the district court of the expenses incurred of trying to apprehend Tao and transporting her and housing her when she was actually arrested on an unrelated matter. And for all we know, she was being held by a different jurisdiction. We don't even know, you know, what costs are involved there. So, yes, to answer the court's question, the state has an affirmative duty to present evidence in the district court. And they had ample opportunity, by the way. This case was litigated in the district court over quite a while. I want to say almost a year. So there was ample opportunity for the state to submit affidavits or whatever they were going to do to support their argument that they've been prejudiced. Their mere assertion that the defendant hadn't been sentenced yet, I think, is without merit. And I'm out of time, so I'll save my questions for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jeffrey Wald. I am an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I represent respondent, State of Minnesota, in this appeal. This is not a close case. The issue is whether Judge Diamond abused his discretion when he denied appellant's repeated requests for reinstatement of two bail bonds. But Judge Diamond did not abuse his discretion in analyzing the four Shetsky factors. His decision to order forfeiture of both bonds at issue in this appeal was no knee-jerk reaction. Instead, on at least three separate occasions, Judge Diamond reviewed appellant's request for reinstatement of the bonds and concluded that complete forfeiture was appropriate. In total, Midwest Bonding paid $50,000 for three separate bail bonds, only two of which are at issue in this appeal, but all of which were forfeited because of the defendant's continued failures to appear. This court should now affirm Judge Diamond's decision and conclude that he acted well within his discretion when he discharged the bail bonds. And jumping into the four Shetsky factors that appellant was analyzing, the first factor, of course, is the purpose of the bail, the civil nature of the proceedings, and the cause, purpose, and length of the defendant's absence. And I want to just speak for a moment about the five failure to appears. And it is true that Judge Diamond did mention that there were five failure to appears. And in fact, that was not an erroneous factual finding. There were five failures to appear. And it's important to note that that order, that February 5th, I think it was 2020, that order dealt with all three of the bonds, not just the two bonds that are issued in this appeal. So Judge Diamond's mention of all five failure to appears was no an abuse of discretion or citing facts that were not relevant because all three bail bonds were at issue in that order. And even not considering the two failure to appears that occurred after the January 2019 failure to appear for trial, which is when the two bonds at issue at this appeal were forfeited, there were two failure to appears prior to that hearing. The dates are in my brief, but I think they were omnibus hearings or pretrial hearings.
Can I just clarify, wouldn't it be important, though, for a court to narrow findings to a particular bond that's at question? And so in some cases you might, and we often have the overlapping situation, but there might be some cases where, and I don't know if that's the case here because they're not before, is where some bond may be reinstated, others not. And that has to do with the particular facts of each given bond period, and what conduct of the defendant during that particular period.
Certainly, it would be clear and perhaps a little bit clearer for this court on appeal to review exactly the factual findings and exactly which failure to appears applied to which bond. But there's no abuse of discretion or erroneous findings here. It's pretty clear to decipher which failure to appears happened before the forfeiture of the first two bonds and which happened afterwards. We're talking about three failure to appears prior to the forfeiture of the first two bonds. And so we're not just talking about a bond is issued a few weeks later, there's a preliminary hearing and the defendant fails to appear and the judge quickly forfeits the bond. No, this was a ongoing case where there had been multiple opportunities for defendant to appear and multiple failure to appear. I think it's important. And even if it was only one failure to appear, only if it was that that trial date, Judge Diamond noted that that's important. We're not talking about a preliminary hearing. We're talking about a trial date, and that's an important consideration. Also of important to this first factor.
Counsel, I just want to, if you're moving on to another factor, maybe you're not, but just on the first factor then, I just want clarity. Are you arguing that that the district court's consideration of the other four failures to appear is a legitimate consideration? I mean, you call it, the court mentioned it. It seems like you're distancing yourself from it. Whereas in fact, there's one paragraph of analysis, of true analysis by the district court relative to these facts. And it seems to be in fact highlighted. It leads the paragraph. So I don't know if you are calling it a mere mention because that implicitly is suggesting it wouldn't be appropriate to consider, or if you think that the other absences are appropriate to consider.
Your Honor, I think that all three of the first absences are appropriate. And I mention all five just to note that it's not as if Judge Diamond is pulling from outside of relevancy, because all three bonds were at issue. And so that's why he mentions five failure to appear. It's not like there's only the two bonds and then he's imputing these other failure to appear. It's unclear how much weight Judge Diamond gave to the number of failure to appear. I think it's appropriate for him to consider that this wasn't just one. We're talking about three that relate to this bond. But even if we discredit the number of failure to appear, still the length, the absence, is one of the considerations for the first factor. And we're talking about a 124-day absence from the failure to appear to the time that defendant was first brought into custody. And that's not considering the amount of time then that she remained in custody in Cottage Grove, which, and I'm blanking on the case, but there's a precedential case that says, no, you can actually look at the time that the defendant is not in your county because the defendant is being held in another county. And that period of time under the precedential case law is a significant period of time. Not talking about a month or even 2 months. We're talking about 4.5 months. Further, looking at the purpose of the bail, one purpose is to encourage sureties to pay penalties for failures to appear. And that's exactly what happened here. A bond was issued and the defendant failed to appear. And one of the purposes then is for someone in appellant's shoes to then pay a penalty. That's what Judge Diamond ordered. And then finally, another purpose is to guarantee the reappearance of the defendant, which, as this court has already noted and Judge Diamond noted, it wasn't appellant who guaranteed the defendant's appearance. It was the Cottage Grove Police Department. So the first factor, Judge Diamond did not err in his analysis, did not err in finding that this factor weighed in favor of forfeiture. Going on to the second factor, that the good faith of the bond company as measured by the fault or willfulness of the defendant. And as I mentioned in my brief, I do encourage this court to publish this opinion and to once again clarify that factors 2 and 3 are distinct. Factor 2 has nothing to do with the good faith of the bond company. It has to do with the willfulness or fault of the defendant, which is then imputed to the bond company.
Can I ask you, counsel, on your request to publish, is there an appellate court, a precedential appellate court decision that makes the mistake that you're saying needs to be corrected? Or is it that you're arguing that perhaps it's not understood by some parties that what the second factor means?
Correct, Your Honor, the latter. I know of no precedential, published or unpublished, precedential or non-precedential decision that calls into question. It should be pretty clear from the published case law, including Storkamp, which appellant quotes at length and talked about today. In Storkamp, the issue was not whether you can look at the good faith efforts of a bond company in factor two. It was simply whether factor two is dispositive, which is what the district court effectively held in that case, that, well, the defendant had acted in bad faith and failing to appear, therefore forfeiture. And Storckamp said, no, you have to weigh factor two and three. You look at the bad faith of the defendant and then the good faith of the bonding company, and you weigh those. And that's what this court made clear in Aiden. And to the extent that an appellant such as Midwest is going to continue to try to conflate the two, I think it would be helpful for this court to put that argument to rest in a precedential opinion.
Mr. Wald, would you agree? I kind of suggested earlier, it seems to me factor two, you just automatically check it as never a favoring reinstatement for the arguments Mr. McGeaney persuasively made, because we can presume that it was willful because that's why they're gone. And so therefore that will always. And so really, I'm wondering as a practical matter, how helpful that ever is for either a district court or this court in its analysis. And really the bigger picture seems to me prejudice, and what efforts did the bond company make? And yet those two seem like more solid than really any of the other factors, because we always know the purpose, and maybe the length will have a big impact. But here, 124 days, I'm guessing Ramsey County was busy, as were the judges with other cases, and the person shows up and here we come. So wouldn't that really be the way to look at the factors, is what efforts the bond company made and what prejudice to the state kind of trump the others as a natural practical result?
Well, respectfully, I disagree, counsel, or I disagree, Your Honor, and I disagree with opposing counsel. And just to give a real world example from just a couple of months ago, I was handling a set of omnibus hearings, and there was a failure to appear, and there was a bond, and I asked for forfeiture of the bond, and the bond was forfeited. The following day, I received an email from I think it was the law clerk mentioning that that defendant or counsel for that defendant had contacted Chambers to explain why there had been a failure to appear. I think, and actually that happened on a couple of cases. And so there could be a great number of reasons why there are mitigating circumstances. It could be a sickness. It could be an accident. There could be a reason that the person had to be outside of a town or outside of the state. So there's a whole bunch of reasons one can think of why there might be a mitigating circumstance that justified or excused the absence, that a bond company could then say, no, look, there wasn't bad faith here. Here's the mitigating circumstances. In that case, I said, okay, let's reinstate the bond. That makes sense to me. So I don't think that this is simply always going to be bad faith. It's the appellants, the bond company's burden to show that it wasn't willful. In this case, appellant has conceded that they have no information. And so when there's no information, this court has to presume that it was, the non-appearance was willful or done in bad faith, and that's imputed.
Mr. Wald, can I jump you to the fourth factor? I'm interested to hear your response to the exchange that I had with Mr. McGeaney, where, you know, he discussed the state's obligation to establish prejudice. Do you agree with that proposition, that you had some affirmative obligation to present evidence in the case? If not, how was the district court supposed to assess that factor?
Your Honor, I disagree that there was an affirmative obligation for the state to provide evidence in order for this factor to weigh in favor of forfeiture. Judge Diamond, of course, did find that the factor weighed in favor of forfeiture based off of the fact that there was a delay in the administration of justice. Here, it took 3.5 years for defendant finally to put in a plea, and close to 4 years for her to be sentenced just last August. This was, as I mentioned already, a trial date, not merely a pretrial or an omnibus hearing. And Judge Diamond is an extremely experienced trial judge, and it was completely within his discretion to know that there is a delay and prejudice in the administration of justice when a defendant fails to appear for trial. Necessarily, there's going to be witnesses that have been subpoenaed. The state is going to have had to have made expended scarce resources.
So just to paraphrase, so a judge can just look at Mensis and see, oh, this, you know, this wasn't a Rule 8 hearing. This was a jury trial. So I'm going to assume more prejudice. Is that okay? It seems to be under your analysis that a judge can do that. And sort of, I mean, really act for the state in that capacity, right?
Your Honor, I believe that Judge Diamond acted within his discretion by noting that there is more prejudice, there is more harm to the administration of justice when the failure to appear is for a trial rather than an earlier hearing. Under Vang, also the inability to impose a sentence, and I concede that a sentence has now been imposed on defendant, but once again, it took 4 years. And I also would ask the state for this court to look at the fact that defendant committed another offense while she was out. I see that my time is up. I would ask that this court affirm Judge Diamond's use of his discretion in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. McGinney, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you. A few things. I'll start with counsel's last argument that because the defendant in this case was accused of committing a new offense, that fact that should weigh somehow in the fourth factor. As this court well knows, offenders are presumed innocent in the United States. This was an appearance bond, not a performance bond. That fact is irrelevant in the analysis. To answer Judge Smith's question to respondent's attorney, there is published Supreme Court case law on the second factor, and Storkamp is clear. I'll cite to the case. If this is on page 543 of Storkamp, in fact, if we were to now hold that the bad faith of the defendant automatically trumps the surety's good faith effort to return the defendant to justice and the lack of prejudice to the state, those factors would become largely irrelevant. And that goes to Judge Slider's questions. So clearly,
to me, this just looks like a four-factor test. Some of the factors point in different directions, and that's why there's a balancing that needs to be done by a district court. And then it's reviewed for an abuse of discretion. So factor two, as measured by the defendant's bad faith, looks at the defendant, and then the good faith efforts of the bonding company is factor three. I mean, sure, they point in different directions, but that's not so unusual for a multi-factor test.
No, I agree. I think that is the test, but I think the respondent's arguing that you shouldn't consider the good faith efforts when you look at factor two.
I think that's right. And I don't really see why Storkamp says something differently. It just says that factor two isn't dispositive. You have to look at factor three. That's the way I hear what you just read to me.
I guess, Judge, maybe it's confusing, but I think that when you consider the second factor, you have to consider the third as well together.
Well, you have to consider that overall under Shetsky. You have to consider all four factors. That's a given, I think.
I agree. I only have a few minutes left, so I want to make sure I cover everything. Counsel said one of the purposes of bail was to make the surety pay a penalty. And again, Shetsky is clear. The purpose of bail is not to increase the revenue with the state or to punish the surety. That's exactly opposite what a counsel's arguing to this court, that the purpose of bail is to make the surety pay a penalty. Shetsky's pretty clear that that's not the purpose of bail. In fact, the Shetsky case says the purpose of bail is not a way to increase the revenue of the state or punish the surety. So I think counsel's incorrect in that argument that one of the purposes of bail here is to make appellant pay a penalty. Counsel's argument about all three bonds, again, we have the district court considering in its bad faith analysis another bond that's not an issue in this appeal, that somehow appellant posting another bond for this offender should be held against it in the analysis of the forfeiture of these bonds. And that was in the district court's section in its order about other factors or other circumstances. That's erroneous. And, you know, the standard of review on abuse of discretion is when a district court has an erroneous application of the law. And that's what's happened here. the district court has made an erroneous application of the law in various ways. One, by erroneously applying the factors, and two, by considering facts outside the record. Counsel's argument is a slippery slope. To say that a district court can infer facts because of its experience on the bench, that's just not the practice of law. The district court is not can't be finding facts when there's no evidence been presented. And Askland is clear. The burden is on the state. That's the Supreme Court. To answer Judge Gaitis's question about whether the fourth factor in the state had an obligation, they do. The Supreme Court said so. The burden is on the state. The burden's on the surety in the other three factors and on the state in the fourth factor. That's black letter law in Minnesota. And counsel's argument about the time that the offender was in another jurisdiction should be held against the state, against the appellant. There's a footnote on page 5 of Schatzky that says basically an offender's incarceration in another jurisdiction is in fact a good excuse for them not to appear. So you can't count the offender's incarceration in that other county. In fact, and the offender's available. The state could bring that offender down for prosecution with a writ very easily. So the fact that she was in another jail in Minnesota didn't prevent them from pursuing the prosecution. They could have writted her out and prosecuted her, and I'm out of time. So I appreciate the court's time this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out within the statute.